pulled down. He couldn't recall ever seeing them that way before, and it frightened him just a little bit. The light was on in the kitchen, and he knocked on the door. There was no response. He called out. Again, no answer. Really upset now, he walked to the closest payphone, which was at a hamburger stand at Hyperion and Rowena. He dialed the number of the house, then, getting no response, tried to reach his sister at the restaurant where she worked. Suzanne wasn't working that night, but the manager offered to try her apartment. Frank gave him the number of the payphone. Shortly after 9, she called. She hadn't seen or heard from their mother and stepfather since they had dropped her off at her apartment the previous night. Telling Frank to remain where he was, she called her boyfriend, Joe Dorgan, and told him Frank thought something was wrong at the house. About 9:30, Joe and Suzanne picked up Frank at the hamburger stand, the three driving directly to 3301 Waverly Drive. Rosemary often left a set of house keys in her own car. They found them and opened the back door. Since no one tried the door before using the key, it is unknown whether it was locked. Dorgan suggested that Suzanne remain in the kitchen while he and Frank checked out the rest of the house. They proceeded through the dining room. When they got to the living room, they saw Lino. He was sprawled on his back between the couch and a chair. There was a throw pillow over his head, some kind of cord around his neck, and the tops of his pajamas were torn open so his stomach was bare. Something was protruding from his stomach. He was so still, they knew he was dead. Afraid Suzanne would follow and see what they had, they returned to the kitchen. Joe picked up the kitchen phone to call the police, then, worried that he might be disturbing evidence, put it back down, telling Suzanne, "Everything's okay. Let's get out of here." But Suzanne knew everything wasn't okay. On the refrigerator door, someone had written something in what looked like red paint. Hurrying back down the driveway, they stopped at a duplex across the street, and Dorgan rang the bell of 3308 Waverly Drive. The peephole opened. Dorgan said there had been a stabbing and he wanted to call the police. The person inside refused to open the door, saying, "We'll call the police for you." LAPD's switchboard logged the call at 10:26 p.m., the caller complaining about some juveniles making a disturbance. Unsure whether the person had really made the call, Dorgan had already pushed the bell of the other apartment, 3306. Dr. and Mrs. Mary J. Brigham let the three young people in. However, they were so upset Mrs. Brigham had to complete the call. At 10:35, Unit 6A39, a black-and-white manned by officers W.C. Rodriguez and J.C. Toney was dispatched to the address, arriving very quickly, 5 to 7 minutes later. While Suzanne and Frank remained with the doctor and his wife, Dorgan accompanied the two Hollywood Division officers to the LaBianca residence. Toney covered the back door while Rodriguez went around the house. The front door was closed, but not locked. After one look inside, he ran back to the car and called for a backup unit, a supervisor, and an ambulance. Rodriguez had been on the force only 14 months. He had never discovered a body before. Within a few minutes, ambulance unit G1 arrived, and Lino LaBianca was pronounced DOA, dead on arrival. In addition to the pillow Frank and Joe had seen, there was a bloody pillowcase over his head. The cord around his neck was attached to a massive lamp. The cord knotted so tightly it appeared he had been throttled with it. His hands were tied behind his back with a leather thong. The object protruding from his stomach was an ivory-handled, bi-tined carving fork. In addition to a number of stab wounds in the abdomen, someone had carved the letters W.A.R. in the naked flesh. The backup unit, 6L40, manned by Sergeant Edward L. Klein, arrived just after the ambulance. A veteran of 16 years, Klein took charge, obtaining a pink DOA slip from the two attendants before they left. The pair were already on their way down the driveway when Rodriguez called them back. Klein had found another body in the master bedroom. Rosemary LaBianca was lying face down on the bedroom floor, parallel to the bed and dresser in a large pool of blood. She was wearing a short pink nightgown, and over it an expensive dress, blue with white horizontal stripes, which Suzanne would later identify as one of her mother's favorites. Both nightgown and dress were bunched up over her head, so her back, buttocks, and legs were bare. Klein didn't even try to count the stab wounds, there were so many. Her hands were not tied, but, like Leno, she had a pillowcase over her head and a lamp cord was wrapped around her neck. The cord was attached to one of a pair of bedroom lamps, both of which had overturned. The tautness of the cord, plus a second pool of blood about 2 feet from the body, indicated that perhaps she had tried to crawl, pulling the lamps over while doing so. A second pink DOA slip was filled out for Mrs. Rosemary LaBianca. Joe Dorgan had to tell Suzanne and Frank. There was writing, in what appeared to be blood, in 3 places in the residence. High up on the north wall in the living room, above several paintings, were printed the words, "Death to Pigs." On the south wall, to the left of the front door, even higher up, was the single word, "Rise." There were 2 words on the refrigerator door in the kitchen, the first of which was misspelled. They read, "Helter Skelter." Monday, August 11th, 1969. At 12:15 a.m., the case was assigned to robbery-homicide. Sergeant Danny Galindo, who had spent the previous night on guard duty at the Tate residence, was the first detective to arrive at about 1 a.m. He was joined shortly after by Inspector K.J. McCauley and several other detectives, while an additional unit, ordered by Klein, sealed off the grounds. As with the Tate homicides, however, the reporters, who had already begun to arrive, apparently had little difficulty obtaining inside information. Galindo made a detailed search of the one-story residence. Except for the overturned lamps, there were no signs of a struggle, nor was there any evidence that robbery had been the motive. Among the items that Galindo would log into the county public administrator's report were a man's gold ring, the main stone a 1-carat diamond, the other stones also diamonds, only slightly smaller. 2 woman's rings, both expensive, both in plain view on a dresser in the bedroom. Necklaces, bracelets, camera equipment, handguns, shotguns and rifles, a coin collection, a bag of uncirculated nickels found in the trunk of Lino's Thunderbird worth considerably more than their $400 face value, Lino LaBianca's wallet with credit cards and cash in the glove compartment of his car, 7 watches, 1 a high-priced stopwatch of the type used to clock racehorses, plus numerous other easily fenced items. 7 days later, Frank Struthers returned to the residence with the police. The only missing items, as far as he could determine, were Rosemary's wallet and her wristwatch. Galindo was unable to find any indications of forced entry. However, testing the back door, he found it could be jimmied very easily. He was able to open it with only a strip of celluloid. The detectives made a number of other discoveries. The ivory-handled carving fork found protruding from Lino's stomach belonged to a set found in a kitchen drawer. There were some watermelon rinds in the sink. There were also blood splatters, both there and in the rear bathroom, and a piece of blood-soaked paper was found on the floor in the dining room, its frayed end suggesting that possibly it had been the instrument used to print the words. In many ways, the activities at 3301 Waverly Drive the rest of that night were a replay of those that had occurred at 10050 Cielo Drive less than 48 hours earlier. Even to, in some cases, the same cast, with Sergeant Joe Granado arriving about 3 a.m. to take blood samples. The sample from the kitchen sink wasn't sufficient to determine if it was animal or human, but all the other samples tested positive on the Octolone test, indicating they were human blood. The blood in the rear bathroom, as well as all the blood in the vicinity of Rosemary LaBianca's body, was type A, Rosemary LaBianca's type. All the other samples, including that taken from the rumpled paper and the various writings, were type B, Lino LaBianca's type. This time, Granado didn't take any subtypes. The fingerprint men from SID, Sergeants Harold Dolan and Jay Claiborne, lifted a total of 25 latents, all but six of which would later be identified as belonging to Lena, Rosemary, or Frank. It was apparent to Dolan, from examining those areas where fingerprints should have been but weren't, that an effort had been made to eradicate prints. For example, there was not even a smudge on the ivory handle of the carving fork, on the chrome handle of the refrigerator door, or on the enamel finish of the door itself, all surfaces that readily lent themselves to receiving latent fingerprints. The refrigerator door, on close examination, showed white marks. After the police photographer had finished, a deputy coroner supervised the removal of the bodies. The pillowcases were left in place over the heads of the victims. The lamp cords were cut near the bases, so the knots remained intact for study. A representative of the Animal Regulation Department removed the three dogs, which, when the first officers arrived, had been found inside the house. Left behind were the puzzle pieces, but this time at least a partial pattern was discernible in the similarities. Los Angeles, California, consecutive nights, multiple murders, victims affluent Caucasians, multiple stab wounds, incredible savagery, absence of a conventional motive, no evidence of ransacking or robbery, ropes around the neck of two Tate victims, cords around the necks of both LaBiancas, and the bloody printing. Yet within 24 hours, the police would decide there was no connection between the two sets of murders. Second ritual killings here. Los Feliz couple slain. Link to five-way murder scene. The headlines screamed from the front pages that Monday morning. TV programs were interrupted for updates. To the millions of Angelenos who commuted to work via the freeways, their car radios seemed to broadcast little else. Some of the details were garbled. It was reported, for example, that the pillowcases were white hoods, that the phrase "death to pigs" had been printed in blood on the refrigerator door when it actually appeared on a wall in the living room. But enough information had leaked out for the detectives again to have trouble finding polygraph keys. It was then the fear began. When the news of the Tate homicides broke, even those acquainted with the victims were less fearful than shocked, for simultaneously came the announcement that a suspect had been arrested and charged with the murders. Gerritsen, however, had been in custody when these new murders took place, and with his release that Monday, still looking as puzzled and frightened as when the police captured him, the panic began and spread. If Gerritsen wasn't guilty, then it meant that whoever was still at large. If it could happen in places as widely separated as Los Feliz and Bel Air, to people as disparate as movie colony celebrities and a grocery market owner and his wife, it meant it could happen anywhere, to anyone. Sometimes fear can be measured. Among the barometers, in 2 days, one Beverly Hills sporting goods store sold 200 firearms. Prior to the murders, they averaged 3 or 4 a day. Some of the private security forces doubled, then tripled their personnel. Guard dogs, once priced at $200, now sold for $1,500. Those who supplied them soon ran out. Locksmiths quoted 2-week delays on orders. Accidental shootings, suspicious persons reports, all suddenly increased. The news that there had been 28 murders in Los Angeles that weekend, the average being 1 a day, did nothing to decrease the apprehension. It was reported that Frank Sinatra was in hiding, that Mia Farrow wouldn't attend her friend Sharon's funeral because, a relative explained, Mia is afraid she will be next, that Tony Bennett had moved from his bungalow on the grounds of the Beverly Hills Hotel to an inside suite for greater security, that Steve McQueen now kept a weapon under the front seat of his sports car, that Jerry Lewis had installed an alarm system in his home, complete with closed-circuit TV. Connie Stevens later admitted she had turned her Beverly Hills home into a fortress, mainly because of the Sharon Tate murders. That scared the daylights out of everyone. Friendships ended, romances broke up, people were abruptly dropped from guest lists, parties canceled. For with the fear came suspicion. The killer or killers could be almost anyone. A cloud of fright hung over Southern California more dense than its smog. It would not dissipate for months. As late as the following March, William Clowman would write in Esquire, "In the great houses of Bel Air, terror sends people flying to their telephones when a branch falls from a tree outside." Political Piggy, Hinman. Pig, Tate. Death to Pigs, LaBianca. In each case, written in the blood of one of the victims. Sergeant Buckles still didn't think it important enough to check further. Deputy Medical Examiner David Katsuyama conducted the LaBianca autopsies. Before starting, he removed the pillowcases from the heads of the victims. Only then was it discovered that in addition to the carving fork embedded in his abdomen, a knife had been stuck in Lino LaBianca's throat. Since none of the personnel at the scene had observed the knife, this became one of the LaBianca polygraph keys. There were two others. For some reason, though the phrase "death to pigs" had leaked to the press, neither Rise nor Helter Skelter had. Lino A. LaBianca, 3301 Waverly Drive, male Caucasian, 44 years, 6 feet, 220 pounds, brown eyes, brown hair. Born in Los Angeles, son of the founder of the State Wholesale Grocery Company, Lino had gone into the family business after attending the University of Southern California, eventually becoming president of Gateway Markets, a Southern California chain. As far as the police were able to determine, Lino had no enemies, yet they soon discovered that he, too, had a secret side. Friends and relatives described him as quiet and conservative. They were amazed to learn, after his death, that he owned 9 thoroughbred racehorses, the most prominent being Kildare Lady, and that he was a chronic gambler, frequenting the tracks nearly every racing day, often betting $500 at a time. Nor did they know that he was, at the time of his death, some $230,000 in debt. In the weeks ahead, the LaBianca detectives would do a remarkable job of tracking their way through the tangled maze of Lino LaBianca's complex financial affairs. The possibility that Lino might have been the victim of loan sharks, however, fell apart when it was learned that Rosemary LaBianca was quite wealthy herself, having more than sufficient assets to pay off Lino's debts. One of Lino's former partners, also Italian, who knew of his gambling habits, told the police he thought the murders might have been committed by the mafia. He admitted he had no evidence to support this. However, the detectives did learn that for a short time Lino had been on the board of directors of a Hollywood bank, which LAPD and LASO intelligence units believed was backed by hoodlum money. They had been unable to prove this, though several other board members were indicted and convicted of a kiting scheme. The possibility of a mafia link became one of a number of leads that would have to be checked out. Lino did not have a criminal record. Rosemary had one traffic citation, which dated back to 1957. Lino left $100,000 in insurance, which, since it was to be divided equally among Suzanne, Frank, and the 3 children from his previous marriage, appeared to rule that out as a motive. Lino LaBianca died in the same house in which he had been born, he and Rosemary moving into the family home, which Lino had purchased from his mother in November 1968. Cause of death: multiple stab wounds. Victim had 12 stab wounds plus 14 puncture wounds made by a double-tined fork, for a total of 26 separate wounds, any one of 6 of which could, in and of itself, have been fatal. Rosemary LaBianca, 3301 Waverly Drive, female Caucasian, 38 years, 5'5", 125 pounds, brown hair, brown eyes. It was probable that even Rosemary did not know a great deal about her early years. It was believed that she had been born in Mexico of American parents, then orphaned or abandoned in Arizona. She remained in an orphanage there until the age of 12, when she was adopted by a family named Harmon, who took her to California. She had met her first husband while working as a car hop at the Brown Derby Drive-In in Los Feliz in the late 1940s, while still in her teens. They were divorced in 1958, and it was shortly after this, while working as a waitress at the Los Feliz Inn, that she met and married Lino LaBianca. Her former husband was polygraphed and cleared of any involvement in the crime. Former employers, ex-boyfriends, current business associates were interviewed. None could recall anyone who disliked her. According to Ruth Civic, her partner in boutique carriage, Rosemary had a good head for business. Not only was the shop successful, Rosemary also invested in stocks and commodities and did well. How well was not known until her estate was probated, and it was learned she had left $2,600,000. Abigail Folger, the heiress in the Cielo slayings, had left less than one-fifth that. Mrs. Civic had last seen Rosemary on Friday when they went buying for the store. Rosemary had called on Saturday morning telling her they planned to drive to Lake Isabella and wondering if she could drop by that afternoon and feed the dogs. The LaBiancas had three dogs. All had barked loudly when she approached the house at about 6 p.m. After feeding them, taking the dog food out of the refrigerator, Mrs. Civic checked the doors. All were locked and left. Mrs. Civic's testimony established that whoever wiped the refrigerator handle of Prince had done so sometime after she had been there. Rosemary LaBianca, car hop to millionaires, to murder victim. Cause of death? Multiple stab wounds. Victim had been stabbed a total of 41 times, any one of six of which could, in and of itself, have been fatal. All but one of Lino LaBianca's wounds were to the front of his body. 36 of the 41 inflicted on Rosemary LaBianca were to her back and buttocks. Lino had no defensive wounds, indicating that his hands had probably been bound before he was stabbed. Rosemary had a defensive slash wound on her left jaw. This wound, plus the knife in Lino's throat, indicated that the placing of the pillowcases over the heads of the victims was a belated act, possibly even occurring after they had died. The pillowcases were identified as the LaBianca's own, having been removed from the two pillows on their bed. The knife found in Lino's throat was also theirs. Though it was from a different set than the fork, it matched others found in a kitchen drawer. The dimensions of its blade were length 4 7/8 inches, thickness just under 1/16 inch, width at widest point 13/16 inch, width at narrowest point 3/8 inch. The LaBianca detectives later noted in their report, the knife recovered from his throat appeared to be the weapon used in both homicides. It was a presumption and nothing more, since for some reason Dr. Katsuyama, unlike his superior Dr. Noguchi, who handled the Tate autopsies, did not measure the dimensions of the wounds, nor did the detectives assigned to the LaBianca case ask for these statistics. The ramifications of this one presumption were immense. A single weapon indicated that there was probably a single killer. That the weapon used belonged in the residence meant that the killer had probably arrived unarmed, his decision to kill the pair occurring sometime after he entered the premises. This in turn suggested, 1, that the killer had arrived to commit a burglary or some other crime, then had been surprised when the LaBiancas returned home, or 2, that the victims knew the killer, trusting him enough to let him in at 2 in the morning or thereafter. One little presumption, but it would cause many, many problems later. As would the estimated time of death. Asked by the detectives to determine the time, Katsuyama came up with 3 p.m. Sunday. When other evidence appeared to contradict this, the detectives went back to Katsuyama and asked him to recalculate. He now decided Lino LaBianca had died sometime between 12:30 a.m. and 8:30 p.m. on Sunday, and that Rosemary had died an hour earlier. However, Katsuyama cautioned the time could be affected by room temperature and other variables. All this was so indecisive that the detectives simply ignored it. They knew from Frank Struthers that Lino was a creature of habit. Every night he bought the paper, then read it before going to bed, always starting with the sports section. That section had been open on the coffee table with Leno's reading glasses beside it. From this and other evidence, Leno was wearing pajamas, the bed hadn't yet been slept in, and so forth. They concluded that the murders had probably taken place within an hour or so after the LaBiancas had left Fociano's newsstand, or sometime between 2 and 3 a.m. on Sunday. As early as Monday, police were minimizing the similarities between the two crimes. Inspector K.J. McCauley told reporters, "I don't see any connection between this murder and the others. They're too widely removed. I just don't see any connection." Sergeant Bryce Houchin observed, "There is a similarity, but whether it's the same suspect or a copycat, we just don't know." There were several reasons for discounting the similarities. One was the absence of any apparent link between the victims, another the distance between the crimes. Still another, and more important in formulating a motive, drugs were found at 10,050 Cielo Drive, while there were none at 3301 Waverly Drive. There was one more reason, perhaps the most influential. Even before Gerritsen was released, the Tate detectives had not one, but several very promising new suspects. August 12th to 15th, 1969. From William Tennant, Roman Polanski's business manager, LAPD learned that in mid-March the Polanskis had given a catered party at Cielo with over 100 guests. As at any large Hollywood gathering, there were crashers, among them plus Herb Wilson, plus Larry Madigan, and plus Jeffrey Pickett, nicknamed Pick. Everything in this book is based on fact. In a few instances, the names of persons only tangentially involved have been changed for legal reasons, the plus indicating the substitution of a pseudonym for the true name. The persons were and are real, however, and the incidents depicted are entirely factual. The trio, all in their late 20s, were reputedly dope dealers. During the party, Wilson apparently stepped on Tennant's foot. An argument ensued, Madigan and Pickett taking Wilson's side. Irritated, Roman Polanski had the three men evicted. It was a minor incident, in and of itself hardly cause for five savage murders, but Tennant had heard something else. Pick had once threatened to kill Frykowski. This information had come to him through a friend of Wojtek's, Witold Katanowski, an artist professionally known as Witold K. Not unmindful of the similarity between Pick and the bloody lettered pig on the front door of the Tate residence, detectives interviewed Witold K. From him they learned that after the Polanskis had left for Europe, Wilson, Pickett, Madigan, and a fourth man, plus Gerald Jones, were frequent visitors to the Cielo residence, Wilson and Madigan, according to Witold, supplying Wojtek and Gibby with most of their drugs, including the MDA they had taken before they died. As for Jeffrey Pickett, when Gibby and Wojtek took over Cielo, he moved into their Woodstock residence. Witold was staying there also. Once, during an argument, Pickett tried to strangle the artist. When Wojtek learned of this, he told Pickett to get out. Enraged, Pick swore, "I'll kill them all, and Wojtek will be the first." Numerous others also felt one or more of the men might be involved and passed on their suspicions to the police. John and Michelle Phillips, formerly of the Mamas and Papas group and friends of four of the five Tate victims, said Wilson once drew a gun on Wojtek. Various strip habitués claimed Wilson often bragged that he was a hired killer, that Jones was an expert with knives, always carrying one for throwing, and that Madigan was Sebring's candy man, or cocaine source. More than ever convinced that the Tate homicides were the results of a drug burn or freakout, LAPD began looking for Wilson, Madigan, Pickett, and Jones. For 10 years, Sharon Tate had sought stardom. Now she attained it, in just 3 days. On Tuesday, August 12th, her name moved from the headlines onto theater marquees. Valley of the Dolls was re-released nationally, opening in more than a dozen theaters in the Los Angeles area alone. It was quickly followed by The Fearless Vampire Killers and other films in which the actress had appeared, the only difference being that now she was given star billing. That same day, the police told reporters that they had officially ruled out any connection between the Tate and LaBianca homicides. According to the Los Angeles Times, several officers indicated they were inclined to believe the second slayings were the work of a copycat. From the start, the two investigations had proceeded separately, with different detectives assigned to each. They would continue this way, each team pursuing its own leads. They had one thing in common, though that similarity widened the distance between them. Both were operating on a basic assumption. In nearly 90% of all homicides, the victim knows his killer. In both investigations, the chief focus was now on acquaintances of the victims. In checking out the mafia rumor, the LaBianca detectives interviewed each of Lino's known business associates. All doubted the murders were mafia originated. One man told the detectives that if the mafia had been responsible, he probably would have heard about it. It was a thorough investigation, the detectives even checking to see if the San Diego company where Lino had purchased his speedboat during their 1968 vacation was mafia-financed. It wasn't, though numerous other businesses in the Mission Bay area were allegedly backed by Jewish mafia money. They even questioned Lino's mother, who told them he was a good boy. He never did belong to the association. The elimination of a possible mafia link, however, did not leave the LaBianca detectives without a suspect. In questioning neighbors of the pair, they learned that the house to the east, 3267 Waverly Drive, was vacant and had been for several months. Prior to that, it had been a hippie hangout. The hippies didn't interest them, but another former tenant, plus Fred Gardner, did very much. From his rap sheet and from interviews, they learned that Gardner, a young attorney, has had mental problems in the past and claims he blacks out for periods of time and is not responsible for his actions. During an argument with his father, he grabbed a knife from the kitchen table and chased his father, stating that he would kill him. In September 1968, after being married only 2 weeks, for no apparent reason, he administered a vicious beating to his wife, then grabbed a knife from the kitchen drawer and attempted to kill her. She warded off the blows and managed to escape and call the police. Booked for attempted murder, he was examined by a court-appointed psychiatrist who found he had uncontrolled aggressions of maniacal proportions. Despite this, the charge had been reduced to simple assault. He was released on probation and returned to the practice of law. Since then, Gardner had been arrested a number of times on drunk or drug charges. Following his last arrest for forging a prescription, he was released on $900 bail and promptly skipped. A warrant for his arrest had been issued on August 1st, 9 days before the LaBianca murders. He was believed to be in New York. When the officers questioned Gardner's ex-wife, she told them she could recall 7 separate occasions when Gardner visited the LaBiancas, each time returning with either money or whiskey. When she'd asked him about this, he'd allegedly replied, "It's okay. I know them, and they had better give it to me or else." Had Gardner, with his penchant for kitchen knives, again tried to put the bite on the LaBiancas, this time the couple saying no? The officers contacted an FBI agent in New York to see if he could determine Gardner's present whereabouts. Beloved wife of Roman, Sharon Tate Polanski, 1943-1969. Paul Richard Polanski, their baby. Wednesday was a day of funerals. More than 150 persons attended Sharon Tate's last rites at Holy Cross Cemetery. Among those present were Kirk Douglas, Warren Beatty, Steve McQueen, James Coburn, Lee Marvin, Yul Brynner, Peter Sellers, John and Michelle Phillips. Roman Polanski, wearing dark glasses and accompanied by his doctor, broke down several times during the ceremony, as did Sharon's parents and her 2 young sisters, Patricia and Deborah. Many of the same people, including Polanski, later attended the services for J. Sebring at Wee Kirk of the Heather, Forest Lawn. Additional celebrities included Paul Newman, Henry and Peter Fonda, Alex Cord, and George Hamilton, all former Sebring clients. There were fewer people and fewer flashbulbs as, across the city, six of his high school classmates carried Stephen Parent's body from the small El Monte Church where his services had taken place. Abigail Folger was buried near where she had grown up in Northern California on the San Francisco Peninsula, following a requiem mass in Our Lady of the Wayside Church, which had been built by her grandparents. Wojtek Frakowski's body remained in Los Angeles until relatives in Poland could arrange for it to be returned there for burial. While the Tate victims were being interred, the police were attempting to recreate their lives, in particular, their last day. Friday, August 8th. About 8 a.m., Mrs. Chapman arrived at Cielo. She did what dishes there were, then commenced her regular household chores. About 8:30, Frank Guerrero arrived to paint the room at the north end of the residence. This was to be the nursery. Before starting, Guerrero removed the screens from the windows. At 11 a.m., Roman Polanski called from London. Mrs. Chapman overheard Sharon's side of the conversation. Sharon was worried that Roman wouldn't be home in time for his birthday, August 18th. He apparently assured her that he would be back on August 12th as planned, as Sharon later told Mrs. Chapman this. Sharon informed Roman that she had enrolled him in a course for expectant fathers. Sharon received several other calls, one of them having to do with a neighbor's kitten that had strayed onto the property. Sharon had been feeding it with an eyedropper. When Terry Melcher had moved out, he'd left behind a number of cats, Sharon promising to look after them. They had since multiplied, and Sharon was caring for all 26, plus two dogs, hers and Abigail's. Most of the day, Sharon wore only bikini panties and a bra. This, according to Mrs. Chapman, was her usual at-home attire in hot weather. Shortly before noon, Mrs. Chapman, noticing that there were paw prints and dog splatters on the front door, washed down the whole exterior with vinegar and water. A small detail, which later would become extremely important. Steve Parent had lunch at his home in El Monte. Before returning to work at the plumbing supply company, he asked his mother if she would lay out clean clothes so he could make a quick change before going to his second job at the stereo shop later that afternoon. About 12:30, two of Sharon's friends, Joanna Pettit, Mrs. Alex Cord, and Barbara Lewis, arrived at Cielo for lunch. Mrs. Chapman served them. It was all small talk, the women would later recall, mostly about the expected baby. Sharon showed the two women the nursery and introduced them to Guerrero. This would be actress Joanna Pettit's second close brush with violent death. She had also been a friend of Janice Wiley, who together with her roommate Emily Hoffert had been murdered in New York City in the summer of 1963, in what became known as the Career Girls murder case. About 1 p.m., Sandy Tennant called Sharon. As previously noted, Sharon told her she wasn't planning a party that evening, but did invite her to drop by. An invitation Sandy declined. If one believed all the subsequent talk, half of Hollywood was invited to 10,050 Cielo Drive for a party that night, and at the last minute changed their minds. According to Winifred Chapman, Sandy Tennant, Debbie Tate, and others close to Sharon, there was no party that night, nor was one ever planned. But LAPD probably spent 100 man-hours attempting to locate people who allegedly attended the non-event. Having finished the first coat of paint, Guerrero left about 1:30. He didn't replace the screens, since he intended to return Monday to give the room a final coat. The police later concluded the killers either didn't notice they were off or feared entering a freshly painted room. About 2 p.m., Abigail purchased a bicycle from a shop on Santa Monica Boulevard, arranging for it to be delivered later that afternoon. About the same time, David Martinez, one of Altabelli's two gardeners, arrived at 10,050 Cielo and began work. Wojtek and Abigail arrived not long after this, joining Sharon and her guests for a late lunch. About 3 p.m., the second gardener, Tom Vargas, arrived. As she came in the gate, Abigail was driving out in her Camaro. 5 minutes later, Wojtek also left, driving the Firebird. Joanna Pettit and Barbara Lewis departed about 3:30. At about that same time, Sebring's butler, Amos Russell, served Jay and his current female companion coffee in bed. LAPD eventually located the girl and determined that she had not accompanied Sebring to the Tate residence that night. About 3:45, Jay called Sharon, apparently telling her he would be over earlier than expected. He later called his secretary to pick up his messages, and John Madden to discuss his visit to the San Francisco salon the next day. He didn't mention to either his plans for that evening, but he did tell Madden he had spent the day hard at work on a crest for the new franchise shops. Just after Sebring called Sharon, Mrs. Chapman told her she had finished her work and was leaving for the day. Since it was so hot in the city, Sharon asked her if she would like to stay over. Mrs. Chapman declined. It was undoubtedly the most important decision she ever made. David Martinez was just leaving, and he gave Mrs. Chapman a ride to the bus stop. Vargas remained behind, completing his work. While gardening near the house, he noticed Sharon asleep on the bed in her room. When a delivery man from the air dispatch company arrived with the two blue steamer trunks, Vargas, not wishing to disturb Mrs. Polanski, signed for them. The time, 4:30 p.m., was noted on the receipt. The trunks contained Sharon's clothing, which Roman had shipped from London. Abigail kept her 4:30 appointment with Dr. Flicker. Before Vargas left, about 4:45, he went back to the guest house and asked Gerritsen if he would do some watering over the weekend, as the weather was extremely hot and dry. Across the city, in El Monte, Stephen Parent hurried home, changed clothes, waved to his mother, and was off to his second job. Between 5:30 and 6 p.m., Mrs. Terry Kay was backing out of her driveway at 9845 Eastern Drive when she observed Jay Sebring driving down the road in his Porsche, seemingly in a hurry. Perhaps because her car was blocking his progress, he did not wave in his usual genial manner. Sometime between 6 and 6:30 p.m., Sharon's 13-year-old sister Debbie called her, asking if she could drop by that evening with some friends. Sharon, who tired easily because of her advanced pregnancy, suggested they make it another time. Between 7:30 and 8 p.m., Dennis Hurst arrived at the CLO address to deliver the bicycle Abigail had purchased in his father's shop earlier that day. Sebring, whom Hurst later identified from photographs, answered the door. Hurst saw no one else and observed nothing suspicious. Between 9:45 and 10 p.m., John Delgadio, manager of the El Coyote restaurant on Beverly Boulevard, noted Jay Sebring's name on the waiting list for dinner, party of four. Delgadio didn't actually see Sebring or the others, and it is probable that he was off on the time, as waitress Kathy Palmer, who served the four, recalled they waited in the bar 15 to 20 minutes before a table was available, then, after finishing dinner, left about 9:45 or 10. Shown photographs, she was unable to positively identify Sebring, Tate, Frykowski, or Folger. If Abigail was along, they must have left the restaurant before 10, as it was about this time that Mrs. Folger called the Cielo number and talked to her, confirming that she planned to take the 10 a.m. United flight to San Francisco the next morning. Mrs. Folger told the police that Abigail did not express any alarm or anxiety as to her personal safety or the situation at the Polanski house. A number of people reported seeing Sharon and or Jay at the candy store, the factory, the Daisy, or various other clubs that night. None of the reports checked out. Several persons claimed to have talked by phone with one or the other of the victims between 10 p.m. and midnight. When questioned, they suddenly changed their stories, or told them in such a way that the police concluded they were either confused or lying. About 11 p.m., Steve Parent stopped at Dale's Market in El Monte and asked his friend John Lefebvre if he wanted to go for a ride. Parent had been dating John's younger sister Jean. John suggested they make it another night. About 45 minutes later, Steve Parent arrived at the Cielo address, hoping to sell William Gerritsen a clock radio. Parent left the guest house about 12:15 a.m. He got as far as his Rambler. The police also interviewed a number of other girls rumored to have been with Sebring on the evening of August 8th. Ex-girlfriend of Sebring was supposed to have been with him on 8-8-69. Not so. Last slept with him 7-5-69. Cooperative. Knew he used. See. She does not. Dated him steady for 3 months. Knew nothing of his way-out bedroom activities. Was to go to a party at Cielo that night, but went to a movie instead. It was no small assignment, considering the number of girls the stylist had dated, yet none of the detectives was heard to complain. It wasn't every day they got the chance to talk to starlets, models, a Playboy centerfold, even a dancer in the Lido de Paris show at the Stardust Hotel in Las Vegas. There was another barometer to the fear, the difficulty the police had in locating people. To have suddenly moved a few days after a crime would, in ordinary circumstances, be considered suspicious. But not in this case. From a not untypical report, asked why she had moved right after the murders, she replied that she wasn't sure why, that like everyone else in Hollywood, she was just afraid. August 16th to 30th, 1969. Though the police told the press there had been no new developments, there were some that went unreported. After testing them for blood, Sergeant Joe Granado gave the 3 pieces of gun grip to Sergeant William Lee of the Firearms and Explosives Unit of SID. Lee didn't even have to consult his manuals. One look and he knew the grip was from a high-standard gun. He called Ed Lomax, product manager for the firm that owns High Standard, and arranged to meet him at the police academy. Lomax also made a quick ID. "Only one gun has a grip like that," he told Lee. "The High Standard 22 caliber Longhorn revolver. Popularly known as the Buntline Special, patterned after a pair of revolvers Western author Ned Buntline had made for Marshal Wyatt Earp, the gun had the following specifications. Capacity 9 shots. Barrel 9 1/2 inches. Overall length 15 inches. Walnut grips. Blue finish. Weight 35 ounces. Suggested retail price $69.95. It was, Lomax said, rather a unique revolver. Introduced in April 1967, only 2,700 had been manufactured with this type grip. Lee obtained from Lomax a list of stores where the gun had been sold, plus a photograph of the model, and LAPD began preparing a flyer which they planned to send to every police department in the United States and Canada. A few days after the Lee-Lomax meeting, SID criminalist Dwayne Wolfer went to 10,050 Cielo to conduct sound tests to see whether he could verify or disprove Gerritsen's claim that he had heard neither screams nor gunshots. Using a general-level sound meter and a .22-caliber revolver, and duplicating as closely as possible the conditions that existed on the night of the murders, Wolfer and an assistant proved, one, that if Gerritsen was inside the guest house, as he claimed, he couldn't possibly have heard the shots that killed Stephen Parent, and two, that with the stereo on, with the volume at either 4 or 5, he couldn't have heard either screams or gunshots coming from in front of or inside the main residence. When Officer Wiesenhunt searched the guest house following Gerritsen's arrest, he noticed the volume control on the set was between 4 and 5. The tests supported Gerritsen's story that he did not hear any shots that night. Yet despite Wolfer's scientific findings, there were those at LAPD who still felt that Gerritsen must have heard something. It was almost as if he had been such a good suspect they were reluctant to admit him blameless. In a summary report on the case made up at the end of August, the Tate detectives observed, "In the opinion of the investigating officers and by scientific research by SID, It is highly unlikely that Gerritsen was not aware of the screams, gunshots, and other turmoil that would result from a multiple homicide such as took place in his near proximity. These findings, however, did not absolutely preclude the fact that Gerritsen did not hear or see any of the events connected with the homicides. The evening of Saturday, August 16th, Roman Polanski was interviewed for several hours by LAPD. The following day, he returned to 10,050 Cielo Drive for the first time since the murders. He was accompanied by a writer and a photographer for life, and Peter Hercos, the well-known psychic who had been hired by friends of Jay Sebring to make a reading at the scene. As Polanski identified himself and drove through the gate, the premises still being secured by LAPD, he commented bitterly to Thomas Thompson, the life writer and a longtime acquaintance, "This must be the world-famous orgy house." Thompson asked him how long Gibby and Wojtek had been staying there. "Too long, I guess," he answered. The blue bedsheet that had earlier covered Abigail Folger was still on the lawn. The bloody lettering on the door had faded, but the three letters were still decipherable. The havoc inside seemed to take him aback for a minute, as did the dark stains in the entryway, and once inside the living room, the even larger ones in front of the couch. Polanski climbed the ladder to the loft, found the videotape LAPD had returned, and slipped it into his pocket, according to one of the officers who was present. On climbing back down, he walked from room to room, here and there touching things as if he could conjure up the past. The pillows were still bunched up in the center of the bed, as they had been that morning. "They were always that way when he was gone," he told Thompson, adding simply, "She hugged them instead of me." He lingered a long time at the armoire where, in anticipation, Sharon had kept the baby things. The life photographer took a number of Polaroid shots first to check lighting, placement, angles. Usually these are thrown away after the regular pictures are taken, but Hercos asked if he might have several of them to aid in his impressions, and they were given to him, a gesture the photographer and life would very soon regret. As Polanski looked at objects once familiar, now turned grotesque, he kept asking why. He posed outside the front door, looking as lost and confused as if he had stepped onto one of his own sets to discover everything immutably and grossly changed. Hercos later told the press, "Three men killed Sharon Tate and the other four, and I know who they are. I have identified the killers to the police and told them that these men must be stopped soon. Otherwise, they will kill again." The killers, he added, were friends of Sharon Tate, turned into frenzied homicidal maniacs by massive doses of LSD. The killings, he was quoted as saying, erupted during a black magic ritual known as Guna Guna, its suddenness catching the victims unawares. If Hercos did identify the three men to LAPD, no one bothered to make a report on it. All publicity to the contrary notwithstanding, those in law enforcement have a standard procedure for handling such information. Listen politely, then forget it. Being inadmissible as evidence, it is valueless. Also skeptical of Hercos' explanation was Roman Polanski. He would return to the house several times over the next few days, as if looking for the answer no one else had been able to give him. There was an interesting juxtaposition of stories on the B, or lead local news, page of the Los Angeles Times that Sunday. The big story, Tate, commandeered the top spot, with its headline, "Anatomy of a Mass Murder in Hollywood." Below it was a smaller story, its one-column head reading, "LaBianca Couple, Victims of Slayer, Given Final Rites." To the left of the Tate story, and just above an artist's drawing of the Tate premises, was a much briefer, seemingly unrelated item, chosen, one suspected, because it was small enough to fit the space. Its headline read, "Police Raid Ranch, Arrest 26 Suspects in Auto Theft Ring." It began, 26 persons living in an abandoned Western movie set on an isolated Chatsworth ranch were arrested in a daybreak raid by sheriff's deputies Saturday as suspects in a major auto theft ring. According to deputies, the group had been stealing Volkswagens, then converting them into dune buggies. The story, which did not contain the names of any of those arrested, but did mention that a sizable arsenal of weapons had been seized, concluded, "The ranch is owned by George Spahn, a blind 80-year-old semi-invalid. It is located in the Simi Hills at 12,000 Santa Susana Pass Road." Deputies said Spahn, who lives alone in a house on the ranch, apparently knew there were people living on the set but was unaware of their activity. They said he couldn't get around, and he was afraid of them. It was a minor story, and didn't even rate a follow-up when, a few days later, all the suspects were released, it being discovered they had been arrested on a misstated warrant. Following a report that Wilson, Madigan, Pickett, and Jones were in Canada, LAPD sent the Royal Canadian Mounted Police a want on the four men. RCMP broadcast it, alert reporters picked it up, and within hours the news media in the United States were heralding a break in the Tate case. Although LAPD denied that the four men were suspects, saying they were only wanted for questioning, the impression remained that arrests were imminent. There were phone calls, among them one from Madigan, another from Jones. Jones was in Jamaica and said he would fly back voluntarily if the police wished to talk to him. They admitted they did. Madigan showed up at Parker Center with his attorney. He cooperated fully, agreeing to answer any questions except those which might tend to involve him in the use or sale of narcotics. He admitted having visited Frykowski at the Cielo residence twice during the week before the murders, so it was possible his prints were there. On the night of the murders, Madigan said, he had attended a party given by an airline stewardess who lived in the apartment below his. He had left about 2 or 3 a.m. This was later verified by LAPD, which also checked his prints against the unmatched latents found at the Cielo address, without success. Madigan was given a polygraph and passed, as did Jones when he arrived from Jamaica. Jones said that he and Wilson had been in Jamaica from July 12th to August 17th, at which time he had flown to Los Angeles and Wilson had flown to Toronto. Asked why they had gone to Jamaica, he said they were making a movie about marijuana. Jones' alibi would have to be checked out, but after his polygraph and a negative print check, he ceased to be a good suspect. This left Herb Wilson and Jeffrey Pickett, nicknamed Pick. By this time, LAPD knew where both men were. The publicity had been bad. There was no disputing that. As Stephen Roberts, Los Angeles bureau chief for the New York Times, later put it, all the stories had a common thread, that somehow the victims had brought the murders on themselves. The attitude was summed up in the epigram, "Live freaky, die freaky." Given Roman Polanski's affinity for the macabre, rumors of Sebring's sexual peculiarities, the presence of both Miss Tate and her former lover at the death scene while her husband was away, the anything-goes image of the Hollywood jet set, drugs, and the sudden clamp on police leaks, almost any kind of plot could be fashioned, and was. Sharon Tate was called everything from the queen of the Hollywood orgy scene to a dabbler in satanic arts. Polanski himself was not spared. In the same newspaper, a reader could find one columnist saying the director was so grief-stricken he could not speak, while a second had him nightclubbing with a bevy of airline stewardesses. If he wasn't personally responsible for the murders, more than one paper implied, he must know who committed them. From a national news weekly. Sharon's body was found nude, not clad in bikini pants and a bra, as had first been reported. Sebring was wearing only the torn remnants of a pair of boxer shorts. Frykowski's trousers were down to his ankles. Both Sebring and Tate had X's carved on their bodies. One of Miss Tate's breasts had been cut off, apparently as the result of indiscriminate slashing. Sebring had been sexually mutilated. The rest was equally accurate. No fingerprints were found anywhere. no drug traces were found in any of the five bodies, and so on. Though it read like something from the old Confidential, the article had appeared in Time, its writer apparently having some tall explaining to do when his editors became aware of his imaginative embellishments. Angered by a multitude of slanders, Roman Polanski called a press conference on August 19th, where he castigated newsmen who, for a selfish reason, wrote horrible things.